Percolated Media listeners, and happy Halloween. It's been a while since I've put out a Percolated Media Presents, and I apologize for that, but I wanted to come back in pretty scary fashion, as they say, for this special Halloween edition of the show. For this edition, I wanted to bring in a gentleman that I've been friends with for a while. I actually recorded this interview with him back in February. I was just looking for a good place to put it, but here it is. I've been wanting to discuss Poltergeist for a while, and I thought in a year where we, as the 3 Minute Retrospective podcast, discussed Jurassic Park, talked about Jaws, I felt like my dudes were a little Spielberged out. So to do so, I brought on a guy by the name of David Fertney, who has been behind some websites dedicated to Poltergeist for years. He runs a Poltergeist Facebook group as well. He's a wonderful guy. I have known him for a while. I've been trying to get him to do this for a while now. And he finally said yes. And yes, this was recorded over 8 months ago at this point. But I think it's going to be well worth the wait, because he has some insight as to the makings of Poltergeist 1 through 3. We discuss the remake a little bit. We discuss the future of the franchise and a whole bunch more. I'm so happy that he decided to come on with me. I have some thoughts at the end of this that don't have to do with movies. It's actually World Series time, so I want to give my thoughts on that when this is over. But for now, here's my buddy David Fertney discussing Poltergeist. Enjoy. And I have Dave here. Dave, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Garrett. How's it going today?
It is fantastic. You know, I was just talking in the intro to this particular interview that I've been trying to get you to do this for going on 13 years at this point. You and I consider you, like a lot of people that I meet online, I consider you more of an acquaintance than anything, but we've kept in touch over the years. And, yeah, you know, and you have a magnificent Poltergeist Facebook group. Like, one of the first movie Facebook groups I actually joined was particular group, and it's run very well. I have to ask right off the bat, what finally convinced you to finally get on the air with me?
Normally, like, I generally wouldn't be a fan of, like, doing podcast interviews, but I mean, I did the audio commentaries for part 2 and 3, so I thought, well, this isn't too bad.
Yeah. Before I get into that, let me just back up a bit. So my two idiot podcast hosts, who I love dearly, by the way, I say that out of love. I've been trying to get them to do this series for I don't know how long, okay? Mm-hmm. And there have been times when it's been on the schedule, but somehow, some way, things come up where I've even done intros for them, and it doesn't happen. Now, it could happen in the next few years. I don't know. We just started our own thing a couple years ago, so the possibility's there, but I have to ask you, how did your fandom of Poltergeist actually start?
Probably when I was about 8, I saw the second movie first. I forgot the exact, I know it was on VHS, but I remember watching it several times, and then my stepmother actually rented the original movie from a local video store down in my hometown. And, of course, I got obsessed with it, you know, and I'd watch the first two over and over. And then when I was, the third movie came out in 1988, and my mom took me to go see that one in the theater. And I remember when we were sitting there was only 4 of us in the whole auditorium. It was me, my mom, and these 2 teenage guys who were sitting a few rows back. And it was like a Saturday afternoon matinee, and I guess this was probably a couple of weeks after the general release, so I'm sure the box office had already gone down at that point. And I remember those 2 teenage guys were kind of like making ghost noises behind us, and my mom actually, I think, fell asleep halfway through the movie. But I was enthralled with it. I loved it. And at the time, I thought it was the best one. That's kind of how it started. And then, you know, over time, I got older and started, you know, digging into like old magazine articles. I remember back when I was in middle school, I actually got I ordered old copies of Fangoria magazine, where they had done interviews with people from the first, you know, part 2 and 3. So it really started back then.
Wow. Yeah. Fangoria, big part of my life too, as I've discussed on the show many times. Wow. See, I hesitate to get into my backstory because I do want to do this series, but I will say, my intro, Dave, was
in 1982, my parents, you know, I was an only child at that point. Mm-hmm. If they were going to go somewhere, they had to take me with them. And they went to a drive-in double feature of, get this, it was Poltergeist and Airplane. Were the two movies that were shown. I remember Poltergeist, and I remember Two Big Breasts during Airplane. Those are my real memories of that particular drive-in trip, and I fell in love with it then, too. It's been something that, I mean, it's so near and dear to me. It grabbed me as well. Just the combination of 80s-era Spielberg mixed with, you know, you have Tobe Hooper horror in it. It was grandiose to me, and I've been in love with it ever since. It's definitely in my top 10 of all time. Mm. I love that film so much.
Yeah.
So you watch them as a kid. You really like the first one, obviously. We'll get to your involvement with the releases and things, but how did it grow to the fandom it actually grew into?
Yeah, so I actually, you know, as I got older, I actually decided when I was back in high school, I wanted to major in film. And when I graduated high school in 98, I ended up going to Georgia State, majoring in film and video. And this was actually before Georgia became such a hotbed of film production due to that tax credit. Mm-hmm. So if I had been younger and majored in film later, I may have actually ended up working in the film industry. But in my case, kind of long story, but CNN Center happened to be right down the street from Georgia State. So I got sidetracked in the news, spent 15 years working for CNN. But you know, around that time when I was working there as like a side interest, I started the fan site that I did, the poltergeist3.com. That's actually, it's been around 20 years now because I started it, I think, in about February of 2005. Mm. And I was focusing on the third film initially. And then over time, I added sections going into the details for part one and two. And then I think it was around 2016 when Scream Factory decided to do their special edition Blu-rays of part two and three. And I had actually reached out to them via Facebook Messenger. And I said, hey, if you guys need any extra help, you know, with background information or whatever, I'm available. And then that's eventually how it came around that I was able to do the audio commentaries for both films.
Wow. So you got in contact with them through Facebook Messenger.
Yeah, like they just had their Scream Factory Facebook group, and I think their marketing guy at the time had written back, and then they eventually reached out when they decided to do those two Blu-rays.
Because you had a fan site.
I told them that I had the fan site, and I'd given them the links to my background research.
Okay, all right. Wow, See, I think this is why you and I are friends, because our stories are so interlinked. Because when I graduated college, I ended up taking a job at ABC News. I worked at ABC News in San Francisco for two years.
Wow. Cool.
Before I eventually moved and worked for 20th Century Fox for a set of years. But we both worked in news. That's so incredible to me.
Yeah, it was kind of funny because, like, even during my junior year of college, at the time I was trying to get on with the entertainment side of Turner, which is the parent company of CNN, of course. And I did an internship with Turner Studios Music Production Library and then TurnerClassicMovies.com. But then fall semester of my senior year is when 9/11 happened.
Oh, shit.
And I eventually, you know, since I was always already working at the gift shop there at CNN Center selling, you know, CNN hats and T-shirts part-time, I started to do some, like, temp work with the CNN Archive Video Library, because at the time they had a lot of video coming in, I think, from the Afghanistan War, and so they needed some extra help, you know, dubbing tapes and all that. So I that's kind of how I got in at CNN there and ended up staying there for 15 years, but so you never know, I guess, where you're going to end up.
Never know. In Frisco, my boss over there had a connection to 20th Century Fox, and he sent a good word for me, and that's how I got my gig over there. So, yeah, never freaking know.
Yeah.
So you actually did the audio commentaries. Who'd you do them with?
So originally, they had planned to have two other guys on the audio commentary with me. So it would have been three of us, but then for whatever reason, that kind of fell through. And then they came back to me and said, hey, do you want to do the commentaries by yourself? Which kind of made me nervous because I never done anything like that before, you know, previously. But I said, okay, I'll do it. And I pretty much just they had a guy kind of like a setup like this through Skype, but they had me record it just on my cell phone and on their side. And I think for whatever reason, they ended up using the recording from my cell phone, which is why you can occasionally hear me like typing in my phone's unlock code because it kept like going in the standby. But yeah, they used that, and they and I actually did a page on my site about this, but I guess it was either the MGM lawyers or maybe Scream Factory, whoever it was. They ended up cutting out certain parts of things I had said on the commentary. For both Poltergeist 2 and 3, I guess it was things that they didn't want, you know, to be discussed on the disc. Like, I mentioned at one point, like, the fact that the actors in part 2 been paid a lot more to come back to do the sequel. So they cut that part out, and, you know, it was just things of that nature.
Wow, you'd think that would have been obvious. You know, yeah, like,
yeah. I'm thinking, like, what is so bad about this?
Yeah. But, yeah. It's not like you disparaged it or anything.
Right. And,
oh, that's weird.
And I think also, I know in part 3, they kind of cut out when I was discussing Heather O'Rourke passing away. And I guess there's still a lot of, they're just really touchy about that still. So they also cut out chunks of that. But
well, I guess there was some controversy even at the time. The fact that she was even filming it was controversial.
Yeah, I think it was more so the fact that I had mentioned that after she died that her mother had filed that lawsuit against Kaiser.
Oh, yeah.
Because they felt like she was misdiagnosed. So yeah, they cut that part out.
Bad, David, bad. Let's discuss these films a little bit one by one. I want to get into it a little deep with you because I've been meaning to talk about these, like I said, with my podcast host, but we haven't covered this yet. And I was so happy that you agreed to do this because I want to kind of discuss these films and your opinions on them. So the first one was released about the same summer as E.T. And that movie, speaking of controversy, I mean, that movie was surrounded by controversy, right? It was cursed. There were things going on that set. There's a lot of things about Poltergeist that's just, it's in the stratosphere. Like, what do you think about all that? Like, the whole curse of Poltergeist and everything surrounding it. And of course, you know, you had the tragic death of the teenage daughter in the course of that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really sad. And I know that a lot of the, I guess, like, the controversy around the original film stems from the whole, you know, who really directed it controversy.
I was getting to that. Yeah.
And I guess, you know, there's, you know, different sides of that story. But I think probably lesser known even is really the whole who wrote the script controversy. Mm-hmm. Because there was actually a lawsuit that was filed by two writers against Spielberg and MGM. The writers were Paul Clemens, and who was actually in the movie The Beast Within.
Okay.
And his friend at the time, Bennett Michael Yellen, they had written a story, a treatment called Housebound. And it was basically a haunted house story about a family who had three kids, a daughter, a little girl, and a boy. They move into a house, and eventually the little girl vanishes inside the house, and they can hear her voice calling out for help within the walls of the house. And there were other things like a tree inside the house that comes to life and tries to attack the father. And like at the end, there's bodies that come up out of the floorboards from the house. And so they had this story treatment, and they actually, they registered it with the Writers Guild in, I think, September of 1979. And then in January of 1980, their agents supposedly submitted it to either Amblin's office or Spielberg's office, and then they never heard anything back, or so they say. And so eventually they filed that lawsuit claiming that, you know, certain elements within their story ended up in Poltergeist. And the suit actually stretched out for a 4-year period, and it was settled apparently right before trial in 1986. So it was actually, I think it was after Poltergeist 2 came out when it was finally settled. And what's really fascinating is that, like, there's a whole almost 3,000 page case file that the National Archives has in California, and about maybe 12 years ago, I paid, I don't know, I think it was like $500 to try to get copies of that paperwork. And they sent me basically what I could afford at the time, which was actually 666 pages, 666, from this court file. And I've always wanted to go back and try to pay for more of the copies because it's really fascinating. You've got like depositions in there, you know, court filings, transcripts, all kinds of great stuff. And it's really interesting. And as to the merits of their suit, like, I mean, obviously I'm not a lawyer. I don't really know what exactly happened with that. But, you know, I think that as far as the script of Poltergeist, you have the fact that, okay, Spielberg wrote the treatment, the basic story outline, mm-hmm. and then Michael Grace and Mark Victor wrote a draft. And if you read their draft, and it's really super hard to actually find the exact draft that they wrote, but I obtained a copy of it some years back, their script is actually really different from what ended up on screen.
Really?
It's almost like that would have been an actual Toby Hooper film because at the end, I mean, the neighbor, you know, the guy in the film who Steve gets in that argument with about changing the TV channels. So at the end, in this original version of the script, when they're trying to flee the house, that guy is actually run over with the car and his head gets crushed. And like Carol Ann dies in their version. Diane is raped by the ghost. I mean, it's a lot more graphic. And so I kind of can understand why Spielberg was like, yeah, let's maybe tone this down a little bit. So he decided to, you know, rewrite the script or rewrite that final shooting script. And the question comes in is like, well, did anybody else help him out with the script? He may not have been credited. And from what I've been able to piece together, I've kind of got a strong belief that the two writers who co-wrote the Sugarland Express, I think they actually helped him kind of rewrite that final shooting script for Poltergeist.
That's interesting. I have actually interviewed Michael Grace way back. Okay. I had a different site. It was at a site called Adventure Amigos at the time, and I interviewed him. What an interesting dude. Like, he had story after story. I think I remember, of everything you just said, I do remember him saying that they did kill Carol Ann in the script. But he also had like a ton of like Steven Seagal stories and everything. I mean, he's just a really interesting, if crazy guy. but the other thing I was going to ask you about that too is I'm a massive Stephen King fan, and I heard Spielberg actually approached King to write it too. Did you hear that?
Yeah. Yeah, so actually after Spielberg wrote the story outline, which interestingly was called, the original title was It's Nighttime. So that was his basic story outline. And then he had gone to Stephen King first, hoping that he could write the script. But I think for whatever reason, maybe, you know, King's agent asked for a lot more money than MGM was willing to pay or whatever the reason was. And so I think also part of it was Stephen King was on a boat traveling somewhere, so they were out of contact for a while. So for whatever reason, that didn't work out. So that's why Spielberg then went to Michael Grace and Mark Victor to write that script. Actually, I just looked it up. It's their names had popped out of my head, but it's the guys who wrote Sugarland Express were Matthew Robbins and Hal Barwood.
Okay.
And I had once contacted Matthew Robinson's agent, and I asked him, I said, well, did Matthew ever do any work on Poltergeist? And the guy said yes. So that was interesting. And then when I wrote to Hal Barwood, he had replied to me, and he kind of offered one of those like wishy-washy kind of answers. Like, he didn't really confirm or deny, but he said, if I had worked on it, it would have been like a minor contribution. So I really do have suspicions that both Matthew and Hal had at least contributed to it, and on an uncredited basis, what became the final shooting script of Poltergeist.
So many hands in that cookie jar.
It's
crazy. And I fret at the idea of what King could have come up with that.
Oh, yeah.
Him and Spielberg really, I mean, they were in each other's orbit a few times, because at one point Spielberg and him were going to do Talisman together too. Like, they just never could get together and get going on that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The directing controversy. From what I remember, that has started even before the movie was even released. And
right.
I think the week of, I think Spielberg took out an ad or something to pretty much try to say that, you know, try to put it to bed, I think, to kind of save his own ass, because at that point he was directing E.T. at the same time, and I think it's illegal to do the same movies at the same time, or there was some weird WGA rules about that. So you have really lived on this movie more than I have for the past 30 or so years. What do you think? Like, do you think there's any truth to the rumor that Spielberg was more of a hands-on? Because the only thing I've heard, David, and I'll just get this out there before I give it to you, is Jo Beth Williams. Yeah, she has come out and said, yeah, Steven Spielberg was on set every day, and he directed the majority of my scenes. Other people have come out and said, well, no, Toby did mine. With your research, everything you've done, tell me right now, who the hell directed this film?
So that letter you mentioned that Spielberg had published in Variety, I think the main reason he did that is that that was actually part of the settlement he agreed to with the DGA, because he had to kind of clear the air and, you know, reaffirm that Spielberg, or that Toby, was the director of the film. But I will say that some of the people who worked on it, who have publicly said, yes, this is the Toby Hooper film, have also said something different privately. So wow. I'll just say that. But I think that the way I kind of look at it is that, yes, Toby was the director. He was on set every day. But I feel like it was kind of a situation where Spielberg was kind of breathing down his neck every, you know, throughout those shooting days. And that, you know, if Toby may have called an action on set, that the rest of the crew may have kind of looked at Spielberg, who would like kind of shake his head or nod. So what I have understood is that after the film was done, when it went into post-production, that pretty much that was all Spielberg, that Toby really had little, or if anything, to do with the film after that. That he, you know, Toby turned in his own cut of the movie, and then of course Spielberg, as a producer who had final cut, he, you know, made some changes there. And then I know that Jerry Goldsmith had given an interview where he said that during scoring of the film, the only time he ever even saw Toby was when he came into a scoring session one time and kind of sat there a few minutes and then got up and left. So, you know, really, I think it definitely in post production, I think Spielberg was the main person there. But I mean, and if you look at my site, I've tried to really go through the different articles that have come out over the years, and I've got, you know, both sides of it. I've got people who say, yeah, it was Toby or Spielberg. But it was obvious from the filming that there were rumors going on that, well, Spielberg was probably more in control than what people would have thought otherwise.
1982 was such a turning point in his career, because he was teetering. Like, he had done Jaws, Sugarland Express, Duel, Raiders of the Lost Ark. He was teetering on whether or not to go to a more adult-oriented line of filmmaking, you know, doing more adult stories. But this movie comes out, and E.T. comes out, and Mick Garris, he did a remarkable podcast called Postmortem for many years, and he has said quite a few times that, you know, in the discussions that he had with Spielberg, because he worked with Spielberg on a number of things. He wrote an episode of Amazing Stories, and Spielberg really got his career going. And at one point, he said that Spielberg told him, he goes, Mick, I have so many ideas that would make some people cringe, but now I'm in a point where I can't do that because people expect me to make more movies like E.T. So he really shied away from that. What a crazy trajectory of a career he could have had. But when you look at Poltergeist, the mixture of the family sensibilities along with just the horror aspect of it is, as a kid, it was just a gateway to me. Like, wow, what else could happen if I watch more movies like this? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's such a great mixture. And don't get me wrong, E.T. is in my top 10 as well. It's one of my favorite films ever. But Poltergeist just has that perfect mixture. I mean, you don't see too many PG movies where a guy's face melts off.
Yeah. And what was interesting is that even on things like that, because you would think, oh, well, that must have been Toby Hooper's, you know, idea because of the face pulling and the skeletons in the pool. But actually, it was Spielberg's hands who were pulling at that dummy head.
Oh, wow.
And apparently, like, Toby Hooper almost got sick watching it while they were getting that filmed.
I just imagine Spielberg just, he's the one who chose Hooper for that movie. He's the one who,
right.
He loved Texas Chainsaw Massacre, apparently. It was one of his favorite films of the 70s. So he handpicked him to do this movie. Mm-hmm. And just the controversy that came out of it, I think I felt bad for Toby, honestly,
yeah,
because it was just, it's just one of those situations where, well, you have the most powerful filmmaker in the world, and you are kind of looked at as the second fiddle, and I don't think that's fair, you know?
Right. And Toby, you know, I think initially he had, I think Spielberg, when he first went to Toby, he had offered Toby to do like an alien invasion type of film, that Night Skies project.
Oh yeah.
But Toby was more interested in doing a ghost story because he had had the idea when he worked at Universal, I think, he had found a book in director Robert Wise's desk about poltergeists. So I think he'd initially had an idea about doing a movie about a family that, you know, would live maybe near a cemetery and that had experienced different poltergeist activities in their house. And then I think he had originally wanted to use like the surround sound process, like some of the poltergeist audio effects.
Mm-hmm.
So early on, that was kind of his concept. And then, so I guess in discussions with Spielberg, you know, they realized, okay, let's do something like that. And Spielberg, I think, was actually writing that story treatment while they were filming Raiders.
Oh, wow.
And when you mentioned that you got to see the first film at the drive-in, were you about, what, maybe 8 or 9 at
no,
that time?
No, I was 5.
Oh, 5. Okay. Yeah, I was only 2 when the first film came out. Mm. So I envy people who got to see it in that original theatrical run, you know?
Yeah, barely any memories of it. My parents would take me to the drive-in all the time. Like I remember specifically they took me to a Dirty Harry movie as well. Like they if they were able to get out, they took me with them. You know? But yeah, not many memories of it, but I do remember watching the house get sucked under, and I remember again the face pulling scene and the clown, obviously. I mean every boy around that time remembers the clown from that film. So 4 years later. By the way, before I get to that, I had no idea about the writing controversy that went into this. Between that and Twilight Zone, Spielberg spent a lot of time in the courtrooms around this time.
Yeah. Well, and it was interesting, too, because that lawsuit that the writers filed, you know, they, I think the weakness of their case was that they could never definitively prove that Amblin had ever even received their treatment, because apparently their agent had told the secretary, okay, deliver this script to Spielberg's office. And of course, she had dealt with so many scripts. When she gave her deposition later, she couldn't remember what had crossed her desk, you know. But at the time, their agent had a system where they would either send a cover letter with a script, or if the agent had maybe called the studio and said, hey, I've got a script you might be interested in, in that case, they would just send like a general business card attached to the actual script. And they claimed that they had like one of those, you know, messenger guys, you know, go up to the studio, drop the script off, but they never had a copy of the receipt to show that it was actually delivered. So understandably, Spielberg's lawyers were like, well, you can't prove that we ever even had this script. And I think that as the lawsuit went on, the judge eventually ruled that, I think her phrasing was, there was no fragmented literal similarity between the housebound story treatment and the final script for Poltergeist, but that there were other issues of, I think the phrase was material fact. So I guess other issues that could have been, you know, tried in an actual, you know, jury trial.
Mm-hmm.
And then it, as the case was set to go to jury, that's when they just settled with those two guys. So again, not that I'm saying, I don't know what happened there, but, and I've actually read that housebound treatment. And when you read it, you know, there are similarities, but it doesn't scream, oh, this is Poltergeist. I mean, there's certain things like the little girl vanishing, this tree coming to life. There's actually a scene where this mouth, like the house is like a living entity, and the mouth forms in the hallway or something, and it's trying to suck things in. So like, I could see how they would look at that and be like, wait a minute, this ended up in Poltergeist, you know? But the general sense I have from reading through all the documents that I got and all that was that if something did happen, Spielberg probably was not aware of it. It may have been a situation where maybe one of his ghostwriters had seen something and like tossed it out as an idea that could have been used. In other words, I don't think that the two guys who filed the lawsuit necessarily thought that Spielberg himself, you know, did anything wrong. It was just whoever was on his payroll at the time, maybe they saw something in that script and then tossed out an idea that eventually ended up in, you know, the various script drafts.
I have a personal story that is a lot like this that I will tell you when I hit stop on this recording.
Okay.
So stay on the line with me. I got to talk to you a second about something like that.
Sure.
Because let me just say this. I kind of feel for those guys if what I think is true is true. Okay, so after that, 4 years later, Poltergeist 2 comes out. Now, I don't have too many memories of 2. I saw it much later. All I remember are braces and tequila. Those are the two things I remember about Poltergeist 2. Anything you can tell us about the, like, anything behind the making of that, how that came about, or what went on there?
So, well, first I want to mention it's really sad that due to the recent fires in California, the house that was used is gone, is burned down.
You sent me that message, and I was devastated by that.
Yeah, it's and that was the one, because I've been to California. I actually went to Simi Valley, and I was able to see the original film's house in like 2005, and I never got to see the house from part two because it was in Altadena. And but yeah, I saw a picture online, and you could tell that the post, like the cement or the brick post on the driveway, it was the same, you know, property, but the house, it's gone. But yeah, with part two, so obviously I'm sure the studio would have preferred to have Spielberg back, but they got Freddie Fields to executive produce it. And then what's interesting is that Gary Sherman, who directed part three, he said that the studio had wanted him to do part two at first, and for whatever reason that didn't, you know, pan out. So Michael Grayson and Mark Victor, who had written that draft of the script for part one, they came back and wrote the script for part two, and they also became producers on that film. And then they eventually hired Brian Gibson to direct part two.
Yeah, what was it that made him the director?
Yeah, I think because I can't recall if some of his prior work, he had directed some things, like some documentaries about British rock groups, I think. And he actually eventually went on to direct What's Love Got to Do With It, about Tina Turner. So he was kind of an unusual choice, I think, for a film like that. But and I think that during the making of that, the crew, they kind of got frustrated with him. I know that Zelda Rubinstein didn't really get along with him too well, because I think she sort of felt that he wasn't a fan of her, because originally they were going to bring, they wanted to bring Beatrice Straight back as in the role of Dr. Lesh in part two. Mm-hmm. And then I think she eventually either did another film, or she was sick, or she turned it down or whatever. So when they couldn't get Beatrice back, they contacted Zelda, and they basically took the lines and gave them to the Tangina character. So that's kind of what happened there. But it was also kind of a shame that in part two, they didn't bring back the two scientists from the first film, actors Richard Lawson and Martin Casella, because it would have been great to have seen them back as well. But and then, you know, with part two, they had originally written a line where they mentioned that Dana is away at college, which is, you know, would have explained why Dominic Dunn wasn't in the film. But then, of course, I think they just kept going back and forth about, should we mention it? Is it inappropriate? So ultimately, they never even filmed that line, because that they had changed the draft at that point of the script.
And Dominic Dunn, I've recently looked over her father's whole deposition about that, you know, and God damn, that's just a terrible tragedy to happen.
It was horrible.
I hope that asshole rots in hell. I mean, God damn. One more thing about part one. Did you ever hear, I don't even remember where I heard it. In fact, I might've heard it from you. The Heather O'Rourke, Steven Spielberg story.
Like
where her parents gave him a bottle of champagne. Did you hear this story?
I don't think so.
The story I heard was they had a rap party, and everybody was invited, and Heather O'Rourke was there with her parents. And her parents, as a congratulations, got Steven, just huge Steven, like I know the guy personally. They got Spielberg this big bottle of champagne, and Spielberg knelt down, and he held it out to Heather O'Rourke, and he said, I'm not going to open this until you turn 21 and we can drink it together. And supposedly, he still hasn't opened it. He still has it in his house.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I never heard that story.
Really? Wow. Oh, wow.
No, I had never heard that.
Yeah. Oh, it could be just legend that kind of grew, but when I heard that, I melted.
Well, I know that after she died, Spielberg had written a really nice letter to her mother, and I think he kind of addressed it like as if he was writing to Heather, and it was really, really nice.
Oh, that's sweet. All right, so part two, they got Heather O'Rourke back, they got everybody back. It did pretty good. It has a little bit of a following, you know? There's a particular character in it that people really gravitate to, obviously, because, man, what a frightening character he was. But what are your takeaways from part two, and what did you actually talk about on that commentary? Like, what would you really say?
A lot of things I discussed on the commentary were the fact that if you watch the movie closely, you can see how it's kind of disjointed. And if you notice certain scenes, like there'll be a scene that it kind of, you get the idea that it takes place throughout the course of one day, but then the actors, their clothing, they change clothes like four times throughout the course of the day. And the reason for that is because after they filmed it and were putting it together in post-production, they cut about 15 minutes from the film, and then they re-edited the balance of what was left. So they took certain scenes and moved them around. So, like, for example, you know when at the beginning, Tangina and Taylor are in that cavern beneath the Freelings' empty lot, and Taylor says, "Where is the family now?" And then it cuts to that scene where they're all like in the backyard having a picnic. So originally it was supposed to cut to the scene where they were in the mall where Kane is, you know, chasing after Carol Ann.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other scenes where they just kind of moved them around. So I guess to sort of maybe keep the pace up, or they didn't want to have too many like just dialogue heavy scenes one after the other. So they move things around and make it more action oriented. They had also kind of, after filming in post-production, they went back and they shot a couple more insert scenes, like that scene where before Robbie's brace is attacking, when Carol Ann walks in there and you see like a quick shot of the skeletons in the mirror in the bathroom. They added things like that after the fact, kind of bump up the scare factor. A lot of what I discussed was things related to that, and also, you know, what had been in the original script drafts, like the fact that I think Reverend Henry Kane, that character's name was originally James T. Boatwright. That was the original preacher's name in like the earliest drafts of that script. Mm. And there were, I think they had things, they kind of toned things down as far as to get the production costs under control. Like the original, the whole other side sequence at the end, and you can tell in the finished film, it was really kind of chopped down.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people, when they watch the movie, they really don't like the ending because it's just so abrupt.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And the whole concept of them like floating around on that blue screen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I guess part of the appeal of the first movie is that it never actually showed you what the other side looks like. And then when you do finally see it in part two, it's like 5 seconds and then it's over. So, but I think part two, it was commercially successful, but yeah, critically, not so much. And with part three, they wanted to get initially Craig and Joe Beth back, but of course they said no.
Yeah.
And apparently Michael Grace and Mark Victor also turned it down. So they had to kind of, that's when they went back to Gary Sherman. And then he, of course, wrote the script and got that whole idea of having it set in that big Chicago high-rise.
One building. Before I get to that, before we had social media and assholes like me bugging you for interviews and things, when you ran this site, like, did you reach out to these actors? Did you actually talk to the majority of these actors and people behind the scenes and things?
I reached out via email and I got responses back sometimes. Marty Casella was great. I actually met him. He came to a horror convention here in Atlanta, I think in 2015. It was the Days of the Dead convention.
Uh-huh.
And he and Oliver Robbins were both at an autograph table. And I got to meet Oliver as well. And actually, I ended up taking Martin out to breakfast. So that was really cool.
Oh, that's awesome.
But yeah, he's fantastic. And then, and some other people like Kipley Wentz, who played Scott in Poltergeist 3. He's a great guy. guy, and I've talked to him a lot over the different years there.
That's cool. That I don't want to say it's easy, but with all the means that we have to reach out to these people, it's, you know, when I started over at Adventure Amigos, all I had to do was just like send a message, and they were like, "Oh yeah, I'll come on with you." And you know, that's how I would talk. That it's kind of remarkable that you were able to, you know, get the emails and do the due diligence that you did to get those interviews. Part three. The only thing I remember about part three is he kind of turned it into a teen slasher film because you had Laura Flynn Boyle in it getting one of her first roles. Right. And there's one part that used to scare me as a kid, and that was the part in the parking garage. You watch it now. I watched it recently, and I was just like, oh, wow, why was I so scared of this? But as a kid, it freaked me out. And, of course, the big thing about that movie was the fact that they filmed it, even though supposedly Heather O'Rourke was very sick. She looks like a completely different person in that movie. It's really sad for me to watch now.
Yeah. Yeah, because she had been put on, I think it was cortisone, because at the time, Kaiser had diagnosed her with Crohn's disease. And so to treat that, they put her on the cortisone, but the side effect was that it caused her face to puff up a lot.
Wow. Yeah.
And while they were in Chicago filming that between April and June of 1987, her mother had taken her to a private doctor there to try to see about getting her off that cortisone. And so by the fall of that year, she said that her face had actually gone back to normal. But yeah, so she, you know, had that issue she was dealing with. And then after they had wrapped production in June of 87, the film was actually given a PG rating by the MPAA in November of that year.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the studio felt like, well, this is a horror movie. Wanted to be at least, you know, PG-13, and they wanted to make changes to the ending anyway. So they were making plans to reshoot at least part of the ending, and then that's when they got word that Heather O'Rourke had died, because she passed away February 1st of 1988. And then, you know, at first there was some, you know, Gary didn't even want to finish the film, but the studio thought, well, we've already spent all this money, so you've got to finish it somehow. And so he eventually wrote that new ending, and they filmed it for, I think, about a week in March of 88. So basically, when you watch the movie, when Nancy Allen jumps through that window at the end from outside of the sky, the little skyscraper, you know, window washing thing, when she first stands up in the frozen bedroom, that's the part that they shot after Heather had already passed away.
Wow.
And if they had to use a body double for the very last scene when they're walking out of the mirror, and then I think after that, they did a test screening in various places, and obviously the audience, I'm sure, didn't like the movie anyway, but they decided to tack on that very last shot where you see the lightning bolts striking the high rise at the very end, Kane's evil laughter. They stuck that on there, I guess, to get it more of a standard, you know, horror movie opening for a sequel type of finish.
Yeah.
Not good. Know, it doesn't really make sense, though. Yeah. It's,
Bless Gary Sherman. I've seen, he's another one. He's on my social media as well. He seems like a really nice guy, and I know he tried. But
yeah,
you follow the original and even the second one, which again has a following. I don't know too many people who really like the third.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely a rarity in that regard. Yeah. But I feel like it's,
well, you kind of have to, David. Look what you got yourself into. Yeah.
I mean, it's not as bad as I think people make it out to be. I mean, it definitely has its problems, and I always kind of wish that if MGM had been willing to spend the money, if they could have gotten Craig T. Nelson and Joe Beth Williams back, like how much better it would have been if you had that continuation of the family unit across all three films. And even like the fact that you don't have Jerry Goldsmith music in that is also a big letdown as well.
One of my favorite things about that film is the Siskel and Ebert review, where Ebert just goes on for about 5 minutes about the fact that they say Carol Ann like 20 times in it or something. Like he kept the count and...
Yeah,
but you know what? And Heather O'Rourke, what a tragic story. It's one of those things where you look at Drew Barrymore. Drew Barrymore had such an up and down career at the same age that Heather was. You know, she had a pretty good jump with E.T. And supposedly her and Heather O'Rourke were both up for the Firestarter role as well, which Drew Barrymore had. Because, you got to do the studying, David. Come on.
Yeah,
I'm just kidding.
I know that Heather had also, there was also that that miniseries version of Alice in Wonderland. I'm not sure if you've ever seen it. It came out in the mid-80s.
I did.
I think she was up for that. And I remember watching that in my Catholic school library in maybe like the, I don't know, third grade or something, and getting, that was scary as hell. Like, there were some scary scenes in that movie. I need to actually probably find that DVD and watch it again.
That's funny. But you look at a career like Drew Barrymore, I think Heather Ward could have had a similar career where she could have gone on to embrace what was put forth for her. I mean, who knows? I don't know if she would have had a talk show, for God's sake. But supposedly, she had a really professional attitude on sets. People were, like, she wasn't like a typical little kid. Like, she was professional. She wanted to know what was going on behind the camera at all times. Like, she was really studying to become something in the business. And I think Drew Barrymore has gone on to produce things. I'm pretty sure O'Rourke would have done the same thing. It's really sad what happened.
Yeah, I think she wanted to direct at some point. Yeah, it was really tragic. And I feel like if she hadn't died, there probably would have been a fourth Poltergeist. It may have gone direct to video at that point, but there would have been more sequels, I think.
All right, let's touch upon the remake, the 2014. I think that's around the time me and you really kind of amped up our talks, because you and I were talking a lot around that time. Mm-hmm. Because here comes a remake of a beloved classic. It was around the time they were remaking everything.
Yeah,
Sam Raimi got behind it as a producer. That kind of gave me some hope. I saw the movie, and God dang. You look at 3, and at least 3 had Carol Ann in it. You know, it had a little bit of continuity. But this one, it's just like you put it in the big screen TV, and it just doesn't have the same feel, does it?
Yeah, it's a shame because they had some good actors in that.
Yes.
And I feel like I actually had flown to L.A. to see it. Because I wanted to go to L.A. for vacation anyway around that time. But
you were in L.A.?
Around,
I was there. So, man, we should have gotten together. I didn't know you were there.
I think I saw it at, I forgot which theater. But the movie, I mean, it's the first half of it's actually pretty good. Right up to the point where the little girl is kidnapped. Mm-hmm. Then it goes downhill because it becomes so, like, paint by the numbers. And it was just very bland to me. And what's interesting is that I've read an earlier draft of the script for the remake, and originally it was, they kept all the same character names. So it would have been Steven, Carol Ann, the original Freeling family. It would have kept all those names. But then when they rewrote the script, they changed all the names, changed the name of the subdivision. They took out certain things, like they left out the Beast, which was such a big part of the original movie. And I kind of got the impression that maybe they did that for legal reasons, because MGM released the remake, but Warner Brothers had acquired the rights to the original film back in when Turner, you know, got them years ago. So it's like right now, Warner Brothers, I think, retains ownership of the first movie, whereas MGM retains ownership of the sequels and then did the remake. So maybe it was a situation where they weren't allowed to use the same character names because Warner Brothers now owns it. So I don't know how that went down, but that was my thought, you know, when I first read those different script drafts.
Yeah, you're right. They got really good actors. Rockwell, I believe he was the father.
Yeah,
right?
Sam Rockwell.
Sam Rockwell. And I remember the trailers actually being pretty decent.
Yeah, yeah.
But the movie itself, I wasn't a big fan of, and unfortunately. But from what I'm hearing, they're looking at maybe revamping it, aren't they? There's some talk that they may try this again.
Yeah, so there's actually going to be an Amazon series based on the first film, and it's actually being produced by Amblin. So,
oh wow,
Spielberg has at least some possible basic input into it. They actually announced the writers of it. I've got a Variety article here from a few months ago. So it's Kalinda Vasquez and Robbie Thompson are on board that project as writers, showrunners, and executive producers.
Okay.
And they don't have any plot details right now, but I hope that they actually make it a direct continuation somehow of the first movie, or even the sequels. I'd like that too, but I hope it isn't like, I don't know if you recall back in the 90s, they had that Poltergeist.
The Legacy series. Yeah.
That was actually pretty good, but it had nothing to do with the movies, which is frustrating.
I don't know, man. See, here's what they're going to bump up against. Everybody, and you're about as old as me, so you remember this as well. Everybody has woken up in the middle of the night and had the TV be nothing but snow.
Mm-hmm.
In the 80s, and that's what made that movie so powerful to me, was the fact that it was snow and there was something in the TV that was out to get me.
Oh yeah.
of course, with the clown imagery and the tree and everything else that we've discussed in this podcast. But how are they going to replicate that? How are they going to make it feel fresh? I don't know if there's a way. You know,
I'm curious how they're going to do it. I mean, I wish them the best, but I hope they don't cause like a fan backlash with whatever they end up, you know, coming up with. But yeah, we'll see. You know, I had hoped that the remake would have, like, the only way that I can really watch that remake is if I look at it as like a set in the same universe sequel. So it's just like about another family in another subdivision that happens to have these hauntings. I mean, there was no need to remake the first film at that point. I mean, yeah. So
your site's still up, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So do you have any, have you had any like talks with any of people behind this, or has it just been gone all under the radar?
Yeah, I've actually tried to reach out, I think, to some of those writers and never heard anything back. So I'm sure they're not going to be talking to me anytime soon. But I wish them the best. But I'm just glad that with the sequels that I did the audio commentaries for, Scream Factory released those back in 2017. And then last year, they actually put out a new 4K edition of Poltergeist 2 that also had my commentary on it. Mm-hmm. And then there's a German company called Wicked Vision, and they put out their own special editions of Poltergeist 2 and 3 last year. And they used my commentaries again. And then their versions, actually, I kind of think are better than the Scream Factory one, just because it includes all the same features the Scream Factory versions had. But they also had some additional things like... they got like a YouTube video of an on like a current location visit to the different locations of Poltergeist 3. So they have some cool stuff on those if you want to check that out.
Definitely. What are those so that people can actually reach out and?
Yeah. So if you go to, I think it's called Wicked Vision. It's a German company, and you can order both those Blu-rays from their site.
Cool. That and Scream Factory. You know, I did have the Scream Factory ones at one point, and in one of my moves, they got lost. But I did have them, and I had your commentaries on them. All right. Well, whenever the TV show comes out, David, you're more than welcome to come back. I would love to talk more Poltergeist with you. I can talk with you forever about this.
Absolutely.
It was such a seminal movie for me. It meant so much to me. Yes. In childhood, if you go to my letterbox, it's like my fourth favorite on there. It's just, it has so much meaning to me, and the fact that somebody, you know, had as much love for it and actually did something about that love and made the site that you did. And you've always been really kind to me every time I reached out to you. And
oh, no problem.
So yeah, in the future, I would love for you to come back, man. Thanks for taking some time and talking some Poltergeist with me.
Absolutely, Garrett. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
All right, Dave, such a wonderful dude, such a nice dude. I love talking to him. Maybe I can get him to talk again in the future. I'm sorry, Dave, that I waited this long to post this interview. But again, like I said, I was just looking for the right time. And you brought the goods, man. I'm very, very happy with that interview. Thank you, sir, for your time. Okay, what else is going on? Well, we have the World Series going on right now. We are, at the time I record this, it's going to be game 6 tomorrow. Toronto's ahead 3-2 over the Dodgers. Man alive, who would have picked this? We knew the Dodgers were going to be there. Toronto had some ups and downs throughout the course of the season, but they were pretty much on top of their division in the American League East for a while. They took out the Yankees. God knows, I didn't know if I was going to watch the series because, as people know, I am a Mets fan. And you talk about a collapse. I mean, the two New York teams I root for collapse more than fucking head being shot by the Punisher, to quote a future retrospective that we're going to be doing. So I wasn't really looking forward to this series. Then the first game happened and Toronto beat them to shreds. And I was like, this could be interesting. And LA won the next game. LA won the next game after that. And then Toronto won another game, and here we are. I mean, my God, Toronto's one game away from winning this World Series, and what a story that would be. I am really excited about this World Series. I don't know how I got suckered into it. God knows I am not into football anymore. That game's rules have really alienated me. Just everything about that sport has just destroyed my confidence in actually liking that sport again. This World Series has been exciting. I'm really happy with the way it's turning out. And even if LA wins, which who knows? I mean, they can win two games in a row. It's been an exciting series, and that's all I could really ask for at the end of October. All right, what's coming up? Well, next week we are going to be discussing Jaws, the first Jaws. Yes, it's going to be November when it's going to be really cold outside, but we recorded those podcasts a couple months ago at this point, and if people have been paying attention, Adam has not seen 2 through 4, and we have already recorded those shows. They are really funny shows. I've already edited them. They are all set to be posted. So you're going to get those once a week for the next few weeks. And then after that, well, we announce what we're discussing at the end of Jaws Revenge. And let's just put it this way. If we put Adam through the doldrums of Stephen King and everything else, he's going to get a bone thrown in his way, because this is something he is actually excited to talk about. So I'm going to save that for the end of Jaws Revenge. But oh, also I want to say too that I actually was able to go to Garbage this week. My beautiful fiance surprised me with birthday tickets to Garbage here in Reno, and they put on a hell of a show. Their farewell tour, they are up there in my top 2, top 3 bands. Me and Adam have a real history with that band, and that one day Adam got this CD from, I don't know if it was a record company, if it was a music magazine, something, and we put it in the CD-ROM and we were listening, and there's the first few bars of Vow from Garbage, and we're listening, we're like, who the hell are these people? We saw the band being advertised, we were excited, and then God, who would have thought that 30 years later they would still be going strong? This is going to be supposedly their last North American headlining tour. And if you look online, Shirley Manson does give interviews as to why she's made that decision. She also reiterated that when she was on stage when we saw them. I respect her decision. At the same time, it's going to be sad to not see them headline. She did say that they'll probably do festival tours and whatnot. They're not fully retiring, and they might still put out records, which, by the way, this last record they did is excellent. I've been listening to it on repeat on Spotify, and it is just, the music that they still put out is great. I've always respected Shirley Manson. I've always respected that she does not give a fuck. She will say what she wants. They will play the music that they want. They have not ever... They have a distinct sound, but they've never sounded exactly the same each passing record, which I respect. And there's so much about that band I just totally respect. So in honor of them, I am going to end this podcast with a song from them. So stay tuned for that. People, thank you so much for... God, it's already been close to... We're going to be coming up on 4 years we've been doing this site. Time sure flies when you're having fun. And we haven't even started. We are... not even making a dent in Marvel. Like, we have so much more Marvel to go. We just recorded a set of shows for that retrospective that if you want to hear Garrett be angry, you're going to want to stay tuned, because I get really angry on those to the point where it almost turns into a Last Jedi podcast at one point. But stay tuned for that and so much more in the new year. Thank you guys for always being dedicated, for always being there. And thank you to Dave once again for being my guest 8 months ago. Yes, it's finally here. I'm finally releasing the podcast. And thank you, sir. Till we discuss Jaws next week, guys, be happy on Halloween. Be safe on Halloween. And we'll talk next week. Thank you, guys.